I'm Alan McClellan, delighted to be here in Rockport and looking forward to bringing you the Takash String Quartet on WCRB in concert from Rockport Music. Edward Dusenberry is the first violinist of the Takash String Quartet, but not the first violinist of the group. You joined the ensemble in 1993.
That's right. Yeah, my predecessor was wonderful founding first violinist Gabor Tokach Nagy, who was at the formation of the group in 1975 in Budapest. And so I replaced him in 1993, but he's now very active as a conductor and a teacher.
What was that like to begin or to join a group that was already formed and happening and all colleagues and friends?
It was a crazy adventure. I was fresh out of school at Juilliard. And maybe when you're that age, you're a little more cocky and able to take chances. And I must say that the others were very nice to me. They never patronized me or said, well, you know, we've been doing this for 18 years, so we don't suggest that musical idea. They kind of let me find my way of doing things. So that's the only reason it worked, really.
And the other non-original member of the ensemble is Geraldine Wolfer. But she's not the second violist of the ensemble. How did that history go?
That's right. Well, the founding violist, Gabor Ormai, I worked with him for only 18 months. And tragically, he died of cancer very suddenly in 1995. And then for 10 years, our violist was the English violist Roger Tapping, who actually relocated to Boston after that and is now the violist of the Juilliard Quartet. And then Jerry joined us. Now it's nearly 11 years ago, actually more than 11 years ago. And she had been principal viola of San Francisco Symphony for 29 years before she joined us.
You have written a book about the experience of joining this ensemble, and I must say I'm so impressed with how deeply personally you've presented this and how thoroughly you've thought about all the issues around string quartets and Beethoven and joining the string quartet. The book is called Beethoven for a Later Age, Living with the String Quartets. We can talk about that a little bit later. Tonight's program is Beethoven, all Beethoven. And you've done, as I say, just a lot of thinking about this music. How do you go about communicating that thought and that intense thought to the audience sitting, hearing this perhaps for the first time?
An old Beethoven concert is a special animal. And we always try and do, as of this evening, an early and a more of a middle piece and a later one, so that you can see the incredible evolution between the pieces, which is not to say that the first Opus 18, one of his early quartets, it's already a masterpiece. It's just that you hear much more the influence of Haydn and Mozart, and especially their Haydn's humor. But then Opus 95 is a completely different world, nicknamed the Serioso, not even really intended for a general audience. And it's full of these kind of harsh changes of mood, very sudden changes of mood, very terse, kind of explosive piece of music. And then Opus 131 is probably, if I had to choose one, my favorite and many people's favorite of Beethoven's quartets, written right at the end of his life. An amazing piece in seven movements with no breaks between the movements. So again, incredible changes of mood between the movements, but somehow it all hangs together. And I think whenever we're playing a Beethoven program, we're just trying to tap into that amazing spirit of innovation and fantasy that runs throughout his music. And of course, it's a little bit of a contradiction because we have to rehearse very hard. We have to know what we're doing and exactly what's happening next. And yet at the same time, we try to recreate it in a way that it has elements of surprise and fantasy in it.
So there are all these technical details that you have to think about, and yet the experience you want the audience to have is something perhaps that has totally different meaning for them.
Yeah, and the great thing about Beethoven quartets particularly is that audience members can experience them in very different ways, and you can have a tremendous emotional spectrum over the evening. You might feel very soothed in a particular place and a bit disoriented and uncomfortable in another. And it's our job as performers to try and bind those different elements together for an audience. And I suppose I feel quite reassured to be playing Beethoven. There's some solace in playing, especially the Opus 131 at the moment, because there is someone working with incredibly diverse material within a piece of music. I mean, different types of characters. Sometimes it's sublime and religious. Sometimes it's the simplest folk tune. And yet his goal and our goal is to kind of bind these things together, not to have them as fractured elements. And I think that's something that, especially at this time, we can all pay attention to.
Right, binding things together in general, yeah. I wanted to go back just a bit to the Opus 18, number 2, that you're playing. These have all the reflections of his teacher, Haydn. But how is it like Haydn, or how is it like Mozart?
Well, I think what strikes me about Haydn is the witty dialogue between the instruments. So you can hear, and there's almost a competitive element. You'll hear someone playing a tune and then someone else kind of chipping in with a little comment and then taking over the tune. And another aspect in the last movement, which is full of fun and games, very high-spirited, there are also these pauses, suddenly where the music comes to a stop and you wonder what's going to happen next. And that's very much a characteristic of Haydn's, his kind of dramatic approach. Mozart, I'm more reminded of in the slow movement, which has a wonderful operatic lyrical quality to it in its outer sections, and then a rather sassy little middle section that seems to have nothing whatsoever to do with the slow music. So that's a sort of funny combination of Haydn and Mozart right there.
And then the Opus 95, this is the second one that you're going to do in F major, is one that Beethoven said should never be performed in public. Why wouldn't he have wanted to hear it ever?
I think, yeah, it's a bit of a mystery, and it's quite funny that everyone's just ignored that comment. I mean, it took a while for the piece to be published, but ever since then, everyone's been playing it. It's just rather uncompromising. It's not a piece that is really intended to please. The way it starts off, it's rather sort of angry and almost aggressive, if you like. And even the slow movement doesn't have quite the same soothing sense that or transporting sense that some of his expansive slow movements do. It's an allegretto, and therefore it's just kind of it flows in a way that is sometimes a little bit restless and disturbed, so there's never any real sense of peace. And the third movement is just relentless. I mean, it's a relentless rhythm kind of drummed over and over again. I think it was one of my very favorite endings to the whole piece. After a kind of an agitato, disturbed last movement, he turns it into a kind of a very, very light, frivolous Rossini ending, extremely fast, as if all this kind of angst and F minor storminess, he's kind of just making fun of at the end and kind of blowing it off. And it does seem like a very satirical ending. He's either making fun of the audience, or perhaps he's making fun of Rossini and that type of very light music. But it's definitely ironic. It's not intended to be somehow a very satisfying, virtuosic last movement like one of the 59 quartets. There's a real sense of irony in it, I think.
He'd known about his deafness for a long time by then, so he was maybe a little cynical.
Yeah, I think it, and he was probably very aware of the pressure. I mean, the whole concert scene was changing, and he wanted to have a big audience for his symphonies. He might put on a concert with all of his works, and it was kind of critical that he sold tickets. He was no longer really completely protected by aristocratic patrons. And yet he fought against that. He could write crowd pleasers. In fact, right after that piece, several years later, he wrote this, this ridiculous piece, really, Wellington's Victory, which was all about to celebrate at that time they thought the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and it was performed great success in Vienna. with sort of different sections, the French entrance and the British entrance and march and battle and victory. It was a real crowd pleaser, very, very successful. But he could do that, but there was another side to his personality that really resisted having to please audiences, please patrons, please players. So he had a group of close friends that he and followers that he knew would kind of allow him to write whatever he wanted to. And so I think in this piece, he was sort of writing for them and trying to resist the pressure to be popular.
And he could thumb his nose at Rossini all he liked in private performances.
Exactly, exactly.
And then this Opus 30, 131, written just a year before he died, and that was his favorite as well. I mean, it's a lot of people's favorites. Schumann wrote this eloquent quote that I read, and Schubert said no one should ever write any more music because he's written it all. What would you say is it that makes that true?
I think that the emotional spectrum is one thing. It starts very unusually with a very deeply felt slow movement, a fugal opening where each voice comes in one at a time, joining each other. And then the beautiful transition into a very sort of fleeting, spring-like second movement. The fourth movement is one of his great variation movements that starts with a very simple theme. And the degree in which this theme or the harmonies that the theme's based on are kind of transformed. The harmonies stay very similar, but the number of different characters and colors and textures that he creates, it's like a really good play in the sense that you start with a character, the theme, and then by the end, the character's sort of been transformed so that when you hear the theme come back at the end of the movement, it sounds completely different in terms of the character of the music and the way it's presented. And I think we get in that movement particularly this incredible sense of improvisation and fantasy that he was proud of. He very modestly said that there was less lack of fantasy than in his previous works. And that's a really an understatement.
And you've taken on Beethoven in this book, but much more than that, it's kind of a memoir of your own experience. Again, it's Beethoven for a later age, living with the string quartets. And why did you write this book?
Well, from an early stage after I joined the Tocatsch, I felt like a pretender when I joined the group. You know, I was inexperienced. I was playing with much older colleagues. And one of the things that I did to try and gain confidence in a way was I read as much as I could around the pieces that we were playing. And I got very interested in the story of Beethoven's first players and the first patrons. And it was reassuring to me because sometimes we think, oh, Beethoven, you know, he's this great central pillar of classical music, and therefore we should be able to understand everything he writes. But I was finding that some of this music's quite difficult to understand first time round. And it was reassuring to me to find out that the first players and the first audiences of the Opus 59s or the later quartets, they also had a lot of difficulty with them. And the performances weren't always successful. And so as a young quartet player, when I felt the spotlight was shining rather ferociously on me, it was reassuring to think that I was part of this longer tradition of players and audiences that have been dealing with this challenging music for the last 200 years. And so I started to think, after I'd been in the quartet for 15 plus years, that I wanted to tell a story about the Tocatsch Quartet, what it was like to join, the various ups and downs that any group has to go through over a long career. But I didn't want the book just to be a memoir. I think there are a lot of classical musicians who actually write very well in that style. So I really wanted to tie it back to the first audiences, the kind of sense of how these pieces were created, and maybe to give a little bit more sense, therefore, of the process that went into that they came about because of particular players and particular patrons. It wasn't just a matter of Beethoven's genius, and bringing it up to our story, that of course when you hear a concert, you want to feel that it's a finished product in some sense. That's what an audience doesn't expect it to be, to feel like a rehearsal. And yet from our perspective, we're always tweaking things and changing things. There's an ongoing process at work from one night to the next even. And so I tried to give some sense of that in the book as well.
Yeah, I think you do so beautifully because, you know, when you are in a quartet and you're dealing with the Beethoven string quartets, as you would have to with any string quartet, it's an ongoing process, as you say. I don't want to embarrass you, but I think that perhaps you've done it in your book, so I'll ask you to do it in person, to talk about your colleagues a little bit, because they are especially talented, and they have come together in kind of a special history. Your second violinist, Carolee, is more of an exuberant personality, and how does that play out when you work together?
I think when I first went and worked with the then three Hungarians in Boulder, Colorado, where we're still based, I was struck by their sort of warmth of personality. And, you know, when you're at a music school, you do spend a lot of time kind of trying to correct mistakes. And if you're doing competitions as a young player, that's very much on your mind. I think that it was very liberating for me to work with these Hungarian musicians who... There's always a sense of adventure and warmth and humor in their approach. Not just Korchi, I mean, also András and then Gábor Ormai. And so I hope that we've tried to stay true to that spirit of the young quartet, the young Tokács quartet.
You mean not taking it too seriously?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the trouble is quartets is a very intense way of life. You spend more time with each other than you do with your families, and you have to work very hard. The line between sounding good and not sounding very good is a thin one, and you're always working to, so it is serious work. But these are people, and Jerry is very much part of that spirit, who have good senses of humor, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. I think having four people that you're always traveling around with, you know, it's a little different than being a soloist. If you're four of you in a minivan for 5 hours driving before you play a concert, then everyone needs to lighten up a little bit and just, you know, have some fun. Otherwise, it would be unbearable.
Yes, I would think so. And yeah, just to have that that sense of camaraderie, but a little perspective, a little distance. Like, and I was thinking that too. That you know, when you began, you were young, and they had been going for almost 20 years by then. So quite a cultural shift for you.
Well, and a cultural shift for both of us. I mean, I mentioned in the early chapters of the book, I talked some about that kind of linguistic issue that they had to start rehearsing in English. It was hard for them, and if they ever were feeling something really strongly in rehearsal, then they would just go back into Hungarian because it was so hard to talk in English. I learnt a very colourful variety of Hungarian swear words, and also fairly useless Hungarian phrases that I was, you know, would pick up that actually weren't very helpful. I mentioned in the book the expression "nagyon szép," which means very nice. Not much room for that in a rehearsal conversation. Whereas I learned quickly "megetszer," which means again, once again. That was a much more useful word. So yeah, there was a kind of meeting and a lot of flexibility in terms of trying to come together with our different languages and different backgrounds. But I think that's the wonderful thing about string quartets as pieces of music. They bind people together, and they have to. And you see that right from the beginning of when they were written, when Beethoven, it was because of these pieces that he wrote that were so difficult that created a kind of a new model of professional chamber music making. It was already going on a little bit in other places, in London, for example, but it was after the Opus 59 quartets that the person who commissioned them, Count Razumovsky, recognizing that they were so hard, that he appointed his first quartet in residence at his palace. And that's a sort of model that, in a way, in a different way, continues today. I mean, we have our own residence, not at the palace, but at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So I think this chamber music, and particularly string quartets, are a nice symbol of human endeavor and kind of coming together, and the difficulties of working very closely and collaborating in that way, the ups and downs of that, and how do you make it work. And at some level, you make it work if you're lucky enough to be with three other compatible people, And at some level, you make it work because the music demands it of you. And you don't have a choice. You know that when you're on stage in the evening playing for an audience, it has to be unified interpretation. There's no room for any kind of roadblocks.
Right, personal or musical or otherwise, right? It's quite an amazing journey to go on, and it's fun to go on it with you in your book. I was wondering, Takash has Grammy Awards and multiple different awards for your recordings. Is there a direction you're headed now? Do you have the future path all worked out?
You know, for recordings, we've been doing more quintet repertoire recently. So I think the next release will be it's a mixture. It's a late Dvorak quartet, the A flat major. Wonderful piece. And then the viola quintets, which was written around the same time as the American quartet when he was in Spillville. And that's with the second violist, is a friend of ours, great player Lawrence Power, English violist. So we have tended to do projects that have a quartet and a quintet in them. Recently, we just released the César Franck piano quintet with Marc-André Hamelin and coupled that with the Debussy. And we'll be doing some other quintets, piano quintets, Dohnányi piano quintets, coming up in a year and a half. We're not doing any recording this year because we're doing lots of Beethoven cycles. And we already have recorded the Beethovens, but they take so much physical and emotional energy, we're taking a little breather from recording.
It's wonderful that you're back to Beethoven after the recordings, which were 2005, weren't they?
We did them sort of over from about 2000 to 2004. And what's nice is that Decca actually later this year will re-release them as a box set. They've never come out in one, so it will be possible at a not too extortionate price to get all of them in one box set, I think, later this year.
Edward Dusenberry, thank you so much for your time today, and have a wonderful concert tonight. And thank you for Beethoven.
Thanks. I enjoyed talking.